Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. We kick off the show today with a conversation about meddling with time. Not in the style of H.G. Wells or Doctor Who, but with the very real and somewhat peculiar custom of daylight saving time. This weekend, those of us who still own analog clocks will try to remember to set them 1 hour ahead, but why exactly will we do it? It turns out there are pervasive myths about the origin of daylight saving time, but its true history is weirder than you could ever imagine. Michael Downing is professor of creative writing at Tufts University and author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Michael Downing, welcome to Word of Mouth.
I'm happy to join you.
So many of us, probably most of us, change our clocks twice a year without a second thought, I would think. What inspired you to go deeper and write this book?
Precisely that confusion. I was sticking my finger into the face of my clock one October evening, and I thought, I have no idea what I've been doing for 40 years. I started to do a little bit of research, and the few facts I turned up instantly proved that everything I thought I knew about daylight saving was completely wrong. I'd always thought we did it for the farmers. In some vague way, I was helping American agriculture. The first fact I turned up was that the group most vociferously opposed to daylight saving in the history of the country were the farmers themselves.
Well, that's so funny that you would say farmers, because we had a conversation among our staff before we decided to do this segment. And since everybody had a different idea about why daylight saving is done, I think I thought it had something to do with the railroad. Somebody thought Benjamin Franklin came up with it. A few people said farmers. All that confusion convinced us that we had to do it. So what is the true story?
Well, you know, Benjamin Franklin almost invented daylight saving like he almost invented almost everything else, including lightning, apparently. He was living in Paris in the middle of the 18th century and noticed that Parisians slept through sunrise, which he considered a terrible waste of natural resources. He suggested to the Parisian authorities that they should fire off cannons to wake up the lazy Parisians. This didn't go over so well, but about 100 years later, it's William Willett, a Brit, who's riding through London on his horse and notices the same phenomenon, that people are sleeping through sunrise with their curtains closed, blocking off a natural resource. Because by the 20th century, the world was on clock time, it was possible for William Willett to invent daylight saving, which he did, proposed it to Parliament. It took several times of being laughed out of the place before the Germans suddenly, when World War I begins, decided they'd try daylight saving, the same plan to save energy, thinking if we gave people more sunlight at the end of the day, they would use less electricity.
So what was the public reaction when daylight saving became law? That's a pretty strange thing to change the way we look at time.
It was fantastically unpopular. It was both considered a kind of offense against what people called natural time or God's time, this fussing with the clocks. So what happened immediately is that people who hated daylight saving blamed everything on it. I mean everything from an increase in suicide to a failure of cows to give milk. And similarly, those people who loved daylight saving for various reasons credited it with everything from curing childhood diseases to basically saving the Western world.
Okay, so the way you make it sound, there's almost no benefit, but somebody must have had some sort of benefit or advantage because of daylight saving. So what were the pros?
Here are the pros. It does something very specific. The Chamber of Commerce in this country, even before the first time experiment when World War I was passed, understood if you gave Americans more time at the end of the day with sunlight, they would stop and shop on their way home from work. Daylight saving never worked as an energy saving plan, but it has been a fantastically effective retail spending plan.
You know, this makes me think of a sort of random question, but it occurs to me that I don't know which setup is correct. So are we about to enter the correct time, or are we, do you know what I mean? I'm totally out of my rocker here.
Well, you're in really good company, because we now have 8 months of daylight saving time. So in effect, daylight saving time, which is what we're going on to when we turn our clocks forward on the second Sunday of March, has effectively become standard time. We're on 8 months a year. So we have completely inverted the project of standardized time.
So what are some of the controversies historically and the controversies that are still happening today over daylight saving time? Why is it still being discussed and debated?
Well, there are a number of reasons. First of all, it's principal confusion with daylight saving is that we have been sold it time and again by the Congress on the basis of energy saving. We were first told that we would save electricity. We never did. When we went to 7 months of daylight saving in 1985, Congress told us, assured us that we would save 100 million barrels of oil a day, which we didn't, not only because we don't use oil to save, to make domestic electricity, but it turns out daylight saving actually promotes energy use. When you give Americans more time, they leave the house. But when we go to the ballpark or we go out to the mall, we get in our cars. So daylight saving actually increases gasoline use. But the other arguments against it have really become more pointed as we've spread out the period of daylight saving, which was initially 6 months, and now we're up to 8 months. Here's what happens when you start trying to save daylight in March and November. You get very late sunrise times, particularly in western parts of time zones. For instance, Grand Rapids won't see a sunrise come the second Sunday of March until about 8:15 or 8:20 in the morning.
Wow, that's past the past rush hour.
You got that right. And it's also past the time that most school children are out on the street. Richard Nixon, who was one of the many longtime opponents of daylight saving, who then turned to it to try to solve the energy crisis during the Arab oil embargo of the 70s, tried to start saving daylight in February. There were a few bus accidents, a couple of school children were actually killed, and the plan was immediately scotched. So that's the big objection to these extended hours of daylight saving.
I'm speaking with Michael Downing, professor of creative writing at Tufts University and author of Spring Forward, the Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time, just in time to spring ahead this weekend. So there are some pretty remarkable stories connected to daylight saving time that you write about in your book, including a very bizarre delay of justice in the case of mobster Sam Cardinella. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, absolutely. Poor Sam was convicted of murder, and he was sentenced, and when he was about to be hung, he realized that his sentencing had not accommodated the change in the clocks, and that he was owed an hour, and Cardinella asked for the extra hour of time because he thought, if you're going to kill me, at least kill me fairly. And in fact, he was awarded that, and he was then hung at the proper moment.
Any other funny stories about how daylight saving time has altered the nature of typical events?
One of the most remarkable ideas about daylight saving that went unnoticed for 40 or 50 years was occasioned by Stalin's decision to adopt daylight saving. Of course, Stalin loved messing with the calendar. He was famously trying to get the institution of a five-day week so that there would be no weekends for the workers. And as part of this plan, his first five-year plan, Stalin adopted daylight saving. And he did this, though he pushed the clocks ahead in April that year. And then he forgot to tell the Russians, I'm not making this up, to turn their clocks back. Through the entirety of World War II and the Cold War, all of the clocks in the Soviet Union were off by an hour, and this was not noticed until the 80s when a Wall Street Journal reporter happened to find the problem. So it just goes to show us that in the midst of the measurement of every second seeming to count in the modern world, daylight saving has managed to make a mess of our clocks.
One of the things that drives me nuts, Michael, about daylight saving is it all seems so messy, given that some states choose not to observe it and others do. Historically speaking, which parts of the country have rebelled against changing their clocks, and who's still holding out today?
Well, you know, there was a very clear divide early in the century from the beginning of the experiments in World War I right through until 1966, which is the first year we get a national peacetime policy. And it typically was a rural-urban divide. Cities loved daylight saving time, and urban areas tended to hate it. But as time went on, the conversion process happened. And I do think it's absolutely true that when you give people sunlight, particularly in the colder reaches of the Northern Hemisphere, you give them late summer sunset times, they get addicted to it. We like to be out on the beach and out in the park late on summer nights.
It is nice. I'm looking forward to it.
You got that right. So the only holdout we have now in the 48 contiguous states is Arizona, who have That's the one state that does not use daylight saving time and refuses it on the basis of essentially states' rights, thinking the federal government shouldn't tell them what to do with their clocks. Hawaii has never adopted it because it's basically equatorial, so it has the same amount of sun almost every day, every all through the year.
That would be funny if they did it just because.
Well, you know, they wouldn't be the first. And there are a number of places that are nearly equatorial that have tried daylight saving. Because here's the problem with people not adopting daylight saving. Clock time has only two real utilities, and that's synchronicity and predictability. So when a state like Arizona is off daylight saving, it costs every bus line, every airline, and every truck trading company money to recalculate their schedules just for Arizona's sake.
So given all the reasons we've just talked about, are there any serious pushes to get rid of daylight saving?
No. In fact, the most serious pushes presently are to go on to daylight saving more, that is to extend it. Every 20 years, the Congress gives us another month, and there are many state legislatures, it happens every year, where there is a proposal to go on to full-time daylight saving time. Here's the catch with that. It's been tried. The British did it during World War II, and so did the Americans, and many cities have tried it in America. But what happens is people push their clock ahead onto daylight saving full year, and then come March or April, people's fingers get itchy. And what we end up with, traditionally, is what the British know as double daylight saving time. That is, we're actually 2 hours ahead. So I think the project will probably go forward.
So you started researching daylight saving time in an effort to better understand it. Having spent all this time, having written this book, are you going to be springing ahead this Sunday with a smile, or has your research left you a bit of a reluctant clock changer?
Well, you know, I live in Boston, and it's cold here. So I look forward to those late summer sunset times like everyone else. But I have to admit, the idea of springing forward in the middle of winter just seems preposterous to me. I'm really happy to wait until spring arrives on the calendar to turn my clock ahead.
Michael Downing is professor of creative writing at Tufts University and author of the book Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Michael, I'm not sure it all makes sense, but thank you so much for explaining it to us.
Good luck this Sunday.
Thank you. We leave you with comedian Pete Holmes and his inaccurate but very funny take on daylight saving time.
Why is that a thing? Do you know? Do you know why it's a thing? I looked it up. Farmers. Are you listening? Farmers. Farmers is why we all change our clocks for farmers. They need an extra hour of daylight for their harvest. So we all, 300 million of us, set our clocks back and change our schedule for what, six? Is it six farmers? Seven tops? I'll give you seven, maybe. How did that even go? The first time we did this, how did that conversation go? Was it a phone call and the farmer's like, hey, hello, the government? Is this the direct line to the government? Yes, this is farmers. Listen.
In just a minute, word of mouth continues with singer-songwriter Marissa Nadler. The Boston Globe described her voice as, quote, an intoxicating soprano drenched in gauzy reverb that hits bell-clear heights, lingers, and tapers off like rings of smoke. You can listen for yourself when word of mouth continues. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We're listening to the song Dead City Emily by Marissa Nadler. It's off her latest album, July.
I was coming apart those days. I don't give a damn about the way color.
Marissa Nadler's music has been described as dream folk, a term the Massachusetts-based singer-songwriter embraces. Her vocals, drenched in reverb, have a way of floating over the instrumentation, making for an ethereal, dreamlike listening experience. Producer Zach Nugent spoke with Marissa and asked her why her album is called July, when her music is so often described as dark, sparse, and even frosty.
Well, the name has nothing to do with weather, per se. The record kind of documents one July to the next, like an entire year of my life. It's not quite a concept record, but everything that happens in that year, for the most part, comes up in the songs.
What was behind that idea of documenting a whole year?
There was a catalyst moment on like July 4th, which is documented in Firecrackers, that song that's on the record.
July 4th of last year, we spilled all the blood. How'd you spend your summer day?
It's definitely something where, like, the closer that somebody would listen to the lyrics, maybe they could find some bits of a messy, fiery breakup. And just, I don't need to get into too much detail other than that it was, like, probably one of the lowest points of my life. It kind of, the record deals a lot with, like, coming out of that, and it's actually kind of a positive journey.
That's a pretty dramatic scene for a breakup with fireworks going off all around you.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Independence Day anymore. Like, maybe if someone were to listen to my records and not know me, they would think that I was a sad person, but I'm really not. I think I find melancholy really beautiful. So that's just what kind of appeals to me as an artist in terms of my aesthetic. We'll see, like, if I get married and I'm happily ever after, I think it might be harder for me to write, but then again, maybe I'll be happy living, so...
Gonna make it 17 people in the dark tonight. You see some familiar faces behind the cellular lights.
In the song Drive, the first verse deals with the disillusionment of the music industry. Obviously, there's like an allusion to me playing to, you know, like just kind of getting a little bit frustrated with the grueling day-to-day of touring. But then there's a realization in the chorus, oh, hey, I really love this. So it's kind of a sharp contrast in the song between maybe that disillusionment, but also a profound love of travel that and appreciation for the ability to do that.
Nothing like the way it feels, nothing like the way it feels to drive. Still remember all the words to every song you ever heard. Drive.
Touring and also, like, getting your song used in, like, Grey's Anatomy, for instance, is the way that an artist can make money. Anytime anybody tells me that's selling out, I think that's ridiculous, because I've been touring for a decade, and I've had a very slow incline of my career. There was no overnight success, so I feel like I've earned my indie credibility, like, up to the stars and back in terms of how many shows I've played to 5 people and self-releasing my records, getting dropped by a label, getting re-signed. It's like, I don't care what anybody thinks. At this point, it's like, judge all you want, but, you know, have you lived out of a van or whatever?
Changed in a rest stop in my dress, made sure not to touch the floor. I've done that kind. Thank you.
song, I've Got Your Name, it's kind of a bitter song about a guy that screwed me over.
Okay, this sounds pretty juicy. Can you tell us more?
Well, the chorus is like, I may be another feather. I think it was, you know, my mom always told me, like, you know, the Stevie Nicks song, Players Only Love You When They're Playing?
Yeah, I love that song.
Yeah, me too. I think that holds true to, like, a lot of musician guys. So I'm still thinking about sending that song. Like, there's a couple songs on this record that I still have to mail out to people.
I may be another feather, but I got your name.
Marissa Nadler will be at the Portsmouth Book and Bar on Sunday, March 9th. For more information on the show, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us. There's more Word of Mouth coming up after the news.
Another feather, but I got your name. Riding back to Massachusetts.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The podcast 99% Invisible is all about design and architecture, and it often looks at objects and design elements that we take entirely for granted, like doors.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. The story goes like this. Theophilus Van Kannel hated chivalry. There was nothing he despised more than opening doors for women.
And so Theophilus Van Kannel, or Theo for short, took a German innovation from 1881, the Tür ohne Luftzug, or door without draft of air. He made some improvements to the design, and in 1888 was awarded an American patent for the improved revolving door.
That's our producer, Sam Greenspan.
Van Kannel's 1888 patent states that, quote, "It is perfectly noiseless in its operation and effectually prevents the entrance of wind, snow, rain, or dust." And so for the past 100-plus years, we have had the solution to keep dust and noise and rain and sleet and snow from entering our buildings. And yet, the likelihood that you will actually use it is very, very low.
The problem is that people don't like using revolving doors.
That's Dan Wasilowski.
Howdy.
He works on a project studying people's behavior with respect to revolving doors and the energy savings associated with using revolving doors back when he was a grad student at MIT. Here's the result.
There's 8 times more air exchanged when you use the swing door than when you use the revolving door.
The basic idea of how a revolving door saves energy is that revolving doors never open.
They can prevent the free exchange of air from the outside to the inside.
Opening a swinging door is like tearing a hole in a building. All that heat or air conditioning leaks out, and the building has to kick into high gear to make up for the temperature and humidity fluctuation. Dan Wasilowski and his team observed a building on the MIT campus that had both revolving doors and swinging doors and found that the revolving door usage sat at about 25%. And this shouldn't be a big surprise.
There are people who are afraid of revolving doors.
Oh, man. If you're walking with someone and talking to them, and it's a little bit bigger of a revolving door and you accidentally get in there with them, and then you're with them like really close. Oh, deep breaths. Swinging doors are just easy.
The team realized that, in addition to conserving energy and helping the environment, they could also save MIT more than $7,500 annually if everyone just used the revolving door in this one building. And they found they could raise revolving door usage at that building to 60 or 70% with just some simple signage.
Here at 99PI HQ, we were curious to find out if that could happen here in the Bay Area.
So I went with our intern, Avery Truffleman, to go stake out a building in downtown Oakland.
6, 7... The swinging doors.
This is Avery and Sam in the observation stage. The vestigial scientist part of me has to remind you here that all the data sets we're talking about today are very small, so understand that. But everyone's observations are aligned. Given the choice, revolving doors just aren't that popular.
So it's been 2 minutes in our experiment so far, and how are we doing?
We've got 12 for swinging, 0 for revolving. Has to say, nobody is using the revolving doors.
And when someone did use a revolving door, it was notable.
Okay, market one. Revolving door.
Wow, what a champ.
Aren't they adorable? After a half hour, they tallied up the results.
259 people used swinging doors. 4 people used revolving doors in a 30-minute period.
Okay, so should we...
So, yeah, let's tape up these signs.
It's an arrow that says, please use revolving door. They exchange 8 times less air.
All right, let's see what happens.
And after another 30 minutes, Team 99PI tallied the results.
65, 60, 65. Wow, yeah, 30.5% of people went through the revolving doors when there was a sign pointing to them, as opposed to 1.5% without the signs. So, not too shabby, yeah.
Now, we did not try testing all the variations. Whatever happened, this much is clear. Putting up an arrow on a door makes people do things. And if you want to get people to use a revolving door, that's a good place to start.
That was Roman Mars from the podcast 99% Invisible. You can learn more about the show at 99percentinvisible.org.
No one can deny that a window cleaner isn't attached to his work, especially when he's 102 stories above the streets of New York.
When it officially opened on May 1st, 1931, the Empire State Building took up the mantle of the world's tallest building and became an architectural icon of 20th century engineering. And it's easy to see why. Just a quick glance at the construction stats here. In just 13 months, 3,500 workers assembled over 60,000 tons of steel columns and beams to complete the 102-story building. So what structures are pushing the frontiers of engineering today? To answer that question, 21st century architects are looking back and opting for a more primitive material, wood. Joining me to discuss is Clay Risen. His article, "The World's Most Advanced Building Material is Wood," was published in Popular Science. Clay, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Clay, I have to admit, when I think wood, my knee-jerk reaction is flammable. But I'm guessing architects and engineers probably already thought of that one.
Right. Well, you have to first distinguish between what we think of as wood architecture and what these buildings are being made out of. They're really almost two different materials. When we think of wood buildings, we think of wood frame buildings, so relatively thin beams being put together in a frame structure, and then we put walls around that. And that's fairly flammable. But this kind of wood that we're talking about is very thick. It's what the architects sometimes refer to as plywood on steroids. It's multi-layered and very densely pressed together. And it actually only burns on the outside. When they do fire tests on it, they find that it's the charring that occurs is fairly shallow. And that char actually supports or protects the wood material on the inside so that in a way, it's even more secure than something like a steel building, which tends to lose a lot of its structure as it gets warmer.
So what exactly do these buildings look like? I mean, from the outside, can you tell it's a wood construction?
Usually not, unless an architect wants to emphasize the wood nature of the structure. They're fairly conventional-looking buildings. The material inside is they're planks, if you think of it as planks, and solid walls and floors, but once you put paint and whatever else you want to put on the outside, it looks like any other building.
But of course, one of the advantages of this cross-laminated timber or CLT wood mm-hmm. design that you're talking about is that it can be built much higher than conventional wood buildings were. So what was the limit for timber structures prior to CLT, and how high can they go now?
Well, a lot of the limits were placed by regulations. So we all sort of know there were these horrible fires in the late 19th century and
sure,
early
San Francisco,
20th century.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. And a lot of those, the horrors of those fires were because you had these very relatively tall, 4, 5, 6-story buildings made with wood frames, and they just disintegrated in the fires. So laws were passed. So you really can't build higher than 4 or 5 stories. It sort of depends on where you are in the country. That aside, you really couldn't go much higher than 5 or 6 floors just because of the weight presses down on a wood frame and makes it snap like a toothpick. These buildings, buildings built with CLT, can go much higher. And right now we have buildings being built pretty regularly around the world, going up to 11, 12 stories. And architects and engineers actually say you can go much higher than that. Some even speculate about doing 30-story buildings. If you add a little bit of steel or concrete, you could go up to 40 stories pretty easily using conventional engineering.
Wow. Have they said anything about earthquake resistance or being able to structurally withstand those sorts of environmental catastrophes?
That's another interesting thing. I mean, people, I think, have this assumption that wood would collapse, but actually wood is better in an earthquake because it tends to move a little bit more than a rigid steel structure. It's, you know, if you think about the way that a human being stands up, if you stand rigid and someone shakes you, or if you're in an earthquake and you stand rigid, you're going to fall over. If you have a little give, if you, you allow yourself to kind of go with the movement, you're less likely to fall. And we've seen this in pagoda structures in Japan, where there are some 9-story wood pagodas that have been standing for hundreds of years. And of course, Japan is a high and earthquake-intensive area, so that really stands as proof of concept.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about environmental and economic concerns. Where is wood used for this CLT methodology sourced? And how sustainable is it?
Well, it's very sustainable. One of the things about wood that you don't have with other materials is, of course, wood is a carbon sink. So when you have a living tree, it's absorbing carbon. We know all this from people talking about replanting forests and the problems of deforestation. So, of course, once you cut down a tree and you you use it in a building, you've sequestered that carbon. You've taken it out of the atmosphere and now used it to a productive end. You can always replant the tree. Wood is a truly renewable building material, and it's much easier, even though you use some energy to cut it down and press it and ship it, it's still much better for the environment than the amount of energy that's used and the amount of pollution that's created when you, say, make steel or you mix and assemble concrete structures. You have enormous savings with wood. In terms of where it's sourced, right now, a lot of the cutting-edge manufacturers are still in Austria and sort of Central Europe. These are places where the technology was developed first and where, sort of just by coincidence to some extent, a lot of the building regulatory regimes are friendly toward this kind of construction. It's starting to change. You're having governments in Australia and in North America start to become a little friendlier. And so I think over the next couple of years, you'll see producers opening up manufacturing facilities closer to the places where the demand is.
So if it's environmentally sound, lightweight, and as I read in your article, much cheaper than steel, then why are developers resistant?
Well, a lot of it is just sort of inertia. Mm-hmm. Right now you have architects who for decades have been trained to think in terms of steel and concrete. You have developers who are used to working with steel and concrete. It's a very well-established, easy road to travel. And then, of course, on top of that, you have a regulatory system that, at least in this country, is not necessarily open to this kind of construction. So a lot of it is just sort of convincing people otherwise. And this is what happened in England, say, over the last 10 years, is what initially architects had to push very hard for, to say, well, let's do this thing that really doesn't seem on the surface to make much sense, but we can show you how it would work, and let's do a pilot project, and then we'll do a building a little taller. And now people are starting to come around and say, oh, I see, it really is cheaper, more energy efficient, easier to put together. It makes a lot of sense. And I think what we'll see over the next, say, decade or two is countries like the United States becoming much more open to this kind of construction because, like you said, it makes sense on every level.
Clay Risen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Clay Risen is an editor for the New York Times op-ed section. His article, "The World's Most Advanced Building Material Is Wood," can be found in the latest issue of Popular Science. And we shift in just a minute from manufactured wood to the real kind. Word of Mouth heads to the forests of Barrington, New Hampshire to track animals after the break.
He showed me his room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Across the state this week, nighttime low temps have been dipping below zero, not usually the weather we're hoping for by March. Well, we want to turn that frown upside down and make you embrace these last days of winter. And who better to help than NHPR's environment and education reporter, Sam Evans-Brown.
It may be March, but a quick look outside makes it crystal clear. It's wintertime. If you've been cursing the snow and ice and desperately longing for spring, you're not alone. But let's look on the bright side. All that frozen water offers certain opportunities that just aren't available in the spring. And I'm not talking about expensive and time-consuming snow sports. I'm talking about wildlife tracking. To give you an introduction to tracking, producer Logan Shannon and I headed for the woods of Barrington, New Hampshire.
My name is Dan Gardoki, and I'm one of the founders and the director of White Pine Programs, which is a nature connection nonprofit in southern Maine, but we serve a lot of New England and beyond.
Winter activities can be pretty gear intensive, so one of the beautiful things about tracking is all it takes is some warm clothes and good boots. Gardoki arrives to our Tracking 101 session in a camo jacket and a camo hat.
So this is my multi-purpose clothing. I also do some hunting, so...
He's originally a Jersey boy, but when you're out in the field with him, he can establish his woods cred pretty quickly. We're exchanging pleasantries in the parking lot when, without looking up or skipping a beat, Gardoki says...
There's this nice little breeze coming in, and the tops of these hemlocks, you know, there's these chickadees, little mixed flock of chickadees and titmice and kinglets, and they're just, as far as I can tell, they're just happily feeding. They're making contact calls. They're going back and forth, so that's telling me... Everything's okay as far as we know. There's no goshawks on the edge or Cooper's hawks or any trouble making.
He didn't even look up, and he knows there are no birds of prey around.
Yeah, nope. There goes a little... It's his little chickadee call.
That whistle was Dan, just in case you couldn't tell.
Some people laugh. It's kind of like my shtick, but it's just what I do. I've always been a mimic since I was a little kid. For better or for worse, you can ask my mother.
He's got a whole repertoire.
I'm like, okay, that's the song of black-capped chickadee. There's a robin. And so if I just repeated it a lot, it would stick in my head, and it just was a great way for me to learn.
So, okay. Gardoki establishes that he's a pretty darn good naturalist, and we head off looking for tracks. While it sounds very primeval and mysterious, tracking is really straightforward. You just wander into the woods in the winter and find some marks in the snow and start following them.
But basically, well, what I like to do is just go out and pick up what as fresh a trail as I can find.
But while you might really, really want to see some animals, Gardoki says you should think twice about that.
But something you do want to consider, there are ethics involved here, that if a trail is really, really fresh, you think it's really fresh, you want to think about, do I want to four-track this animal or backtrack this animal? And in general, I'll tell people, the default is you should probably backtrack it.
And that means follow its tracks backwards.
Yeah,
because so you're not chasing it.
Exactly. And these kind of weather and these kind of conditions we've had, some animals, especially like a herd of deer this time of year, as the season goes on, are going to be more and more stressed.
This is maybe confusing. I'll let him flesh that idea out.
It's almost impossible to imagine unless, you know, you were either raised in serious poverty and you really know what hunger is, or you've been stranded. I mean, just to be that hungry. I mean, they're on such a lean energy budget. So lean, especially as late winter comes. If we have deep snows... Well, winter's taking its toll on them. Yeah, it's just, I like to try and just respect that reality for them. And we've got pantries and fridges, they don't, right?
Okay, so you found your track and you're following it, probably backwards. How do you know what you're following? First, how does the animal walk? Foxes, coyotes, and deer leave alternating left-right prints.
And there's actually two tracks in each little hole. So it's like the animal's walking right where its front foot lifts up, its hind foot lands right in there.
Then there are tracks from porcupines, skunks, beavers, or bears called waddlers or pacers.
Frankly, those terms just confuse me. Something with short legs that's chubby.
They leave clear side-by-side footprints with distinct front and back paws.
It's going to leave a funny little wide trail, right? It's going to look like it's plowing its way through the snow, and it's got big old pads. It looks like a trough in deep snow. I mean, it looks like someone would drag the porcupine. You know, if you picture a fat little dog on a leash and you're pulling it through the snow, it's kind of what a porcupine can look like.
Weasels, rabbits, mice, and squirrels are bounders.
What we're looking at are all four tracks in one kind of messy hole in the ground. And that hole's about the size of, you know, a mitten or two in the snow. And what's happening is you have an animal that's bounding. So all 4 feet hit the ground, boom, the animal comes up, lands again.
Once you've got your general category, you start to look for other clues. With some experience and in the right snow, you might be able to just ID the tracks outright. But even if they've melted away or blown in a little bit, there are ways to know what you're following. For instance, you can develop your nose.
Just give a quick sniff of this pee, which some people do, some people don't. Yeah, that definitely is coyote pee. So I'm going to get after this here. So what is coyote pee? I'll let you make your own judgment.
I mean, it's not super strong.
No, it's not. Compared to red fox, it's actually quite faint, quite mellow. It's kind of a weak, slightly sweetish smell. Not the country, but, you know, sweet as in a flavor.
Like a rocky.
But if there aren't any urological or scatological clues left behind, you can just follow the track. When in doubt, follow it out. Look for how far apart the tracks are. If it's bounding, trotting, or shuffling, and then, until you get the knack of it, consult a guidebook. For this track, Gardoki goes through the motions, even though he knows it pretty well.
Coming in around between 3.5 to, sometimes as much as 5.5 inches is the fissure.
Once you learn your tracks and signs, the woods are an entirely different place. Instead of a cold, dead winter day, you see all the life that's just off camera. It turns a walk in the woods into a totally different experience. So we keep going. Gardoki calls out to some kinglets, tiny little fluffed up songbirds, which can survive nights down to as cold as 40 degrees below zero.
Smallest passerine, perching bird, little songbird. They weigh about 6 M&Ms.
There's a leg bone of a deer we stumble across, which has clearly made some carnivore's day.
The fact that the shaft is cracked like that, really the only animal with the jaw strength to do that around here is the coyote.
But the real test comes when we reach a frozen beaver pond. After checking out a beaver lodge
actually,
in the middle,
beavers are actively in the lodge. I'll make a
we circle around to the edge and find two holes in the ice, about the size of a cantaloupe, surrounded by splashes of water and tracks.
Okay.
Gardoki puts it all together, and it's like watching an episode of CSI.
I can break right through. Yeah, it's about the same thickness of the ice. It's maybe not even a centimeter thick. So this probably happened yesterday, or probably even last night. It's cold enough it could have froze up that fast. The snow is smushed down in a very broad, wide pattern, which makes me think something was rolling here or rubbing its body. And that's really typical of both beaver, but especially otter. Now that I'm looking down, I'm seeing some tracks here. 1, 2, 3, 4. It's hard to see. Maybe a fifth toe there. It looks like an otter track. It's not very clear. And the fact that something was rolling, I would expect to also find some sort of scat somewhere around here because otters will come up and roll. But there it is. So just a few feet behind you. Right up here, some really gross, gnarly looking. I mean, it's something you probably wouldn't want to touch with a pole, but I'm going to. And it's pretty frozen now, so it was probably done last night or maybe even yesterday. Although things would freeze pretty fast. And when I look closer at this scat, which I'm just going to break a chunk of snow. I don't even have to touch the scat. Oof, number one, it smells very gross. Well, very strong, like fishy, musky smell. And there are tiny little fish scales in it that if I get the sun on them, I can see, like right there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's diagnostic otter scat. So this is typical. The otters will come up out of the ice. They'll roll around a bunch. Well, they'll scat. They'll scent mark. They'll roll around a bunch and then psh, go right back in the water.
There you have it, folks. Study hard and you too can track like Dan Gardoki. But as good as he is, he's not infallible.
Oh,
we got blood.
Whoa!
All right.
There's another hole in the ice which looks just like the last one, but this time
there's frozen, dirty water kind of staining the snow. But then there's also clearly some very red marks here. Really look like blood.
Okay, first, what kind of animal came up through the hole? Gardoki finds a track that he thinks looks like a beaver foot, but then the smell test gives a conflicting result.
It smells more like otter than beaver. Beaver have their own scent, too.
And then there's that blood. He starts to run through possible theories.
It's curious. I'm trying to rack my brain around mating seasons. Because you can get estrus blood. It's not uncommon.
According to his handy pocket reference, it's mating season for both otter and beaver. But this looks like too much blood.
Otter's meals generally aren't bloody, because they're generally eating a lot of fish, and they'll eat them whole or, even if they tear them up. I'm not getting a fishy smell here, though.
Maybe it's a foot injury, or maybe, well, it's likely one of any of 100 scenarios that you could dream up. One of those improbable stories that's happening every day, everywhere.
Yeah, don't know. I'll leave it at that.
Good mystery. We like to have a little mystery.
Gardoki's life is centered on introducing people to these skills. He does workshops with corporate retreats and schools, and what he has seen is disconcerting.
And they say, you know, most children these days can identify 100 corporate logos by the age of 5, but how many tracks or trees or birds are they going to know in their backyard? Usually less than 10. So we're trying to reverse the trend, but I think the trend is definitely towards more human-focused, human-oriented experiences. And that, I think that results in a big disconnect.
Gardoki isn't the first to lament this disconnect, and a clear way to combat it society-wide has yet to come forward. But if you're concerned like he is, he's got an easy solution for you. Go ahead and get out yourself. And hey, bring someone with you next time.
If you'd like to see photos from the track, visit our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for listening this week. If you missed anything, especially our earlier interview on the bizarre history of daylight saving time, it's all at wordofmouthradio.org. We don't want you to miss us next week, so don't forget to turn your clocks ahead this Sunday. And while you're at it, tell your friends. After all, the best reminders travel via word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth Saturday at noon on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio.
Follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire
Public Radio.